All right, ready to jump into another deep dive?
Always.
Today, we're going to unpack a fascinating maritime law case, Stevens v. Seacoast.
Yeah, this one's a classic.
It really gets to the heart of, you know, a ship owner's responsibility when a seaman, you know, gets injured on the job.
Right, like at first glance, you might think it's pretty straightforward. Someone gets hurt on a ship, the owner's probably liable.
Yeah, you'd think.
But, it gets a little murky when you bring in this concept of a bare boat charter.
Bare boat charter.
Yeah. Think of it like leasing out the entire vessel. The person who charters it is essentially the temporary owner, at least from a legal standpoint.
So does that let the actual ship owner off the hook? Like, if someone's injured, can they just point to this charter agreement and say, not my problem?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and Stevens v. Seacoast really tackles it head-on.
Okay, I'm intrigued. So, set the scene for us.
Oh, yeah.
What exactly happened in this case?
So we've got David Stevens, a 19-year-old kid, no experience at sea whatsoever.
Mm.
He lands a job on this oyster dredging vessel, the MV Elena S.
Okay.
Now, the vessel was owned by Seacoast Company, but it was actually being operated by this young captain under what's called a lay system.
A lay system.
So basically a profit-sharing agreement, so the captain has some skin in the game.
Hmm. So Seacoast owned the boat, but this captain was kind of running the show.
Yeah, exactly.
And I bet that's where the complications come in.
You got it. So Stevens gets injured just 30 minutes into his first day on the job.
Oh, wow.
And believe it or not, the initial trial court actually ruled in favor of Seacoast.
Really?
They accepted this argument that because of the lay system, the captain was essentially acting as a bare boat charterer.
Hold on. So they're saying the captain was like the temporary owner and employer.
Exactly. So according to the trial court, Seacoast had zero liability.
Wait, even if the vessel wasn't safe?
Yeah.
Isn't there, you know, some responsibility to ensure the crew's basic safety no matter what these agreements say?
You would think so, right? That's kind of the common sense approach.
Yeah.
But thankfully, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals took a different view.
Okay, good. So they stepped in and said, hold up, let's take a closer look at this.
Exactly. They weren't so quick to buy this whole bare boat charterer argument. They wanted to figure out who is really calling the shots, who was actually in control.
Okay, I'm starting to see where this is going.
Right, like who's really running this ship?
Exactly.
And what they found is pretty interesting. So you see, the captain, yeah, he hired the crew, but Seacoast, they were still controlling the money.
Oh, I see, I see.
Yeah, they had first dibs on the profits from the oyster harvest. And get this, they were even handling the sales themselves. So, you know.
So it wasn't really this hands-off bare boat charter situation at all.
Not even close.
Sounds like Seacoast was trying to kind of, you know, have their cake and eat it too. Profiting from the operation, but then trying to avoid any responsibility if something went wrong.
That's exactly how the appeals court saw it.
Makes sense.
They were especially concerned about, you know, the potential for exploitation, especially considering how dangerous it can be to work at sea.
Yeah, right. I mean, seamen already face enough risks out there.
Exactly. And maritime law, it really emphasizes protecting those workers.
Well, and let's not forget, I mean, the details of this case weren't exactly, you know, shining a positive light on Seacoast.
Oh, no, not at all. The MV Elena S, it was described as flagrantly unseaworthy.
Flagrantly unseaworthy, wow.
Yeah. It didn't even have basic safety equipment, like a radio or a proper first aid kit.
Seriously.
Seriously. And to make matters worse, Seacoast also failed to provide what's called maintenance and cure.
Maintenance and cure.
It's the legal term for the, you know, medical care and living expenses that are owed to an injured seaman.
Okay. So basically, they were cutting corners on safety, and then when things went wrong, they tried to wash their hands of the whole thing.
Seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The court definitely saw it that way. Their message was loud and clear. You can't just slap a label on someone like bare boat charterer and expect to escape your obligations.
Right. Especially when it comes to the safety and well-being of the crew.
Exactly.
You know, this whole thing kind of reminds me of all the debate around worker classification these days.
Yeah.
Especially with the gig economy and everything.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
You've got companies classifying workers as independent contractors, and well, it seems like they're trying to avoid certain costs and responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So it makes you wonder, could this Stevens v. Seacoast case, like, serve as a warning for other industries?
I think it absolutely could. Those core principles that Stevens v. Seacoast really highlights, scrutinizing control, you know, looking beyond these labels and really prioritizing worker protection,
right,
those are all incredibly relevant to the gig economy.
So am I getting this right? The court basically created some ground rules for when this whole bareboat charter argument actually holds up.
Precisely. They established these legal tests to determine whether an arrangement is truly what's officially called a demise charter, which is, you know, the fancy term for a bareboat charter.
Okay, so they wanted to make sure it wasn't just a sneaky way for a ship owner to get out of their responsibility.
Exactly.
So let's break down these tests. What kind of evidence did the court say would actually prove a ship owner had really handed over control of the vessel?
Okay, so first they looked at what's called independent manning and supply.
Okay.
Did they actually hire and pay the crew on their own? Did they, like, handle getting supplies? Or was the ship owner still involved in all that?
Makes sense. It's not just about who's physically steering the ship. It's who's responsible for, you know, keeping things running and making sure the crew's safe.
Right, exactly.
What else? What other factors did they look at?
So then there's operational control.
Operational control.
Like, who was actually setting the navigation and safety protocols? Was the charterer free to, like, decide on the routes where they fished, you know, the safety procedures, or were they still taking orders from the ship owner?
Ah, so it's all about autonomy. Like, is the charterer actually operating independently,
yeah,
or are they still basically following the ship owner's lead?
Exactly.
Interesting. What else?
Well, how long the arrangement lasts is important too.
Right.
Was it just a one-time thing, like a short-term lease, or was it a long-term agreement? A real, like, bona fide demise charter usually involves, you know, a significant chunk of time to really solidify that transfer of control.
Okay.
And then, of course, there's the financial side of things.
Oh, yeah. Got to follow the money.
Right. Always. So the court looked at financial responsibility.
Okay.
Did the ship owner, did they still have a stake in the profits? Were they involved in selling, like, the catch or controlling the money? If so, that would throw up a big red flag about whether this was a real demise charter.
So basically, the court wanted to make it crystal clear that ship owners couldn't just use this bareboat charter thing as a loophole to avoid taking care of their crew.
Right. They wanted to make sure responsibility was clear. No one could weasel out of it.
I see.
And it's interesting, the Stevens case actually built upon an earlier case, Mike Hook's Inc. v. Pena.
Oh.
And that case also involved a very similar lay system setup.
Interesting. So there was already some legal precedent for, like, taking a hard look at these kinds of situations. What happened in the Mike Hook's case? Was the outcome the same?
Yeah, it was very similar. Just like in Stevens, the court in Mike Hook said, no, this isn't a real bareboat charter, you know, because the ship owner was still calling too many shots, even with that lay system in place.
It's fascinating how these maritime cases can reveal these bigger patterns.
Yeah.
You know, about worker rights and how the law tries to adapt to ensure things are fair.
It really is. And that's what makes maritime law so interesting. It's not just about ships and, you know, dry contracts. It's about, like, the human element, how we treat workers and how we protect them, especially in these kind of risky and evolving industries.
Yeah. I'm starting to see how these legal precedents can have these, like, ripple effects way beyond the world of ships and the sea. Now, I'm curious, how has this case continued to shape the legal landscape? And what lessons does it hold for other industries, especially with the rise of, you know, we were talking about the gig economy? It's amazing how this case from, you know, 1969 about oyster dredging can suddenly feel so relevant today.
I know.
Like, we're not in the age of, you know, wooden ships and scurvy anymore.
Right. But the core issues, they haven't really changed that much.
Yeah. It all comes back to control and responsibility.
Exactly. And in with the way, like, work is changing these days.
Oh, absolutely.
It's more important than ever to figure out who's really in charge and, you know, who's ultimately responsible for the workers.
It feels like we're kind of seeing that play out right now with the gig economy.
Oh, totally. You've got all these companies relying on, you know, quote unquote, independent contractors.
Right.
Think about, like, your ride-sharing apps, food delivery services, freelance platforms.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
And it raises a lot of the same questions that the court was grappling with in Stevens v. Seacoast.
Like, can a company just, you know, call someone an independent contractor and then suddenly they're off the hook for their safety?
Exactly. Like, what about wages, working conditions, or if someone gets hurt on the job?
Are there, like, any lines anymore?
That's the big question, isn't it? Like, where does the company's control end and the workers' supposed independence begin?
So are we saying that, like, Stevens v. Seacoast, a case about, a seaman on an oyster boat, could actually apply to an Uber driver or a DoorDash delivery person.
It's definitely possible. I mean, those core principles in Stevens, scrutinizing control, looking beyond the labels and making sure workers are protected.
Right.
Those are all front and center in the legal battles that are happening right now over like worker classification and the gig economy.
Wow. That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. And it shows how, legal precedents, even from these kind of specific niche areas, can end up having a huge impact in all sorts of unexpected ways.
Well, I know I'm going to be looking at, all those gig economy apps a little differently now.
Me too.
Thinking about, like, who's really calling the shots?
Exactly.
Well, this has been a really fascinating deep dive. Any final thoughts for our listeners before we wrap things up?
Yeah, I think the main takeaway here is that, even cases that seem really specific to one industry, like this one with maritime law, can have these like ripple effects across all sorts of different areas.
Yeah.
Those principles in Stevens v. Seacoast about control and worker well-being and seeing through labels, those are important no matter what kind of work we're talking about.
That's a great point. It's a good reminder that, the law is always evolving and changing, and these legal precedents can have some pretty surprising consequences. Well, thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Stevens v. Seacoast. We hope you found it insightful and maybe even a little bit thought-provoking.